Today at 1 on Hometown Heroes, a World War II Marine explains the story behind the Japanese sword he's held on to.
Well, it brings back tears to my eyes now because when I think about it and think how close I come to getting my head lopped off there.
Another item he brought home from Okinawa, a tiny doll with a heavy and emotional story behind it. That's a story you'll hear this afternoon at 1 on News Talk 580 and FM 105.9, brought to you by Humana, proud to honor our hometown heroes.
As Americans, we enjoy many freedoms. Among them are the freedom to vote, to worship, and to speak our mind. These freedoms have long been protected by the men and women of our armed forces and their families that supported them. For more than 15 years, Humana has made a commitment to our veteran community. That commitment continues today with the introduction of the Humana Preventive Plus package for veterans and their families. In developing this product, we listened to more than 10,000 veterans. With their input and our 50 years of expertise in the healthcare industry, we developed an affordable dental plan that also includes discounts on vision, hearing, retail prescription drugs, and more. We are proud to offer this plan to our veterans and their families right here in Fresno and throughout the country. We are also proud to announce that Humana is now the 2012 exclusive healthcare partner for the MVETS. Find out more about the Humana Preventive Plus package for veterans. Call our Fresno office, 559-221-2522, 559-221-2522.
News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom.
Hometown Heroes is brought to you by Humana. Humana is proud to honor our hometown heroes.
Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday here on KMJ. Maybe you're listening to us on the AM side of your dial at 580, maybe on our FM channel 105.9, or perhaps you're catching us online at kmjnow.com, where you can listen 24 hours a day worldwide. Each week on Hometown Heroes, we visit with veterans of World War II. We want them to know how much we appreciate what they did for our country. We want them to be honored and appreciated for their service and their sacrifice. We want to enjoy the stories and preserve them for posterity, and along the way learn not just a thing or two, but a whole lot about what it means to love your country and the price that's been paid for our freedom. And we're going to get a taste of that today from 86-year-old Dale Anderson of Visalia, California, or originally from Dunlap. And for our listeners who don't know every little city in the valley, or the foothills, as the case may be, why don't you educate our audience of where Dunlap is and what it was like growing up there in the 1930s.
Dunlap is about 50 miles straight east of Fresno up Highway 180. You pass through Squaw Valley, and then Dunlap is off to the right about 5 miles. I grew up there. I had pretty near the whole area as my backyard. I did a lot of hunting as a kid and just roamed around the mountains all up there in Dunlap, and it was really a nice place to grow up.
And people who are familiar with Kings Canyon or Sequoia National Parks would certainly have seen a sign for Dunlap along the way. Did you hang out much in what are now those national parks up there?
Yes, I did. As a family, we worked up in the timber every year, working in the redwoods that was downed there that the early loggers had left. We made fence posts from those redwoods, and also shakes, and I even worked at a shingle mill there in Dunlap. As soon as the snow would go off in the spring, we would load up everything that we had and move up most of the time into Converse Basin, quite a bit of time in the Indian Basin. They're working in the timber, and we'd stay till the snow was just about to come in the fall, and then we moved back to Dunlap. But that was our childhood days up until I was about 14 years old. We did that as far back as I can remember.
And we're going to hear about your time in the 1st Marine Division and even how some of your experience in logging led you to get yourself in a little hot water there when you were in the Marine Corps. But I'm curious if looking around those national parks and people that visit them now have a few stops on their list, and one of them they like to go see the General Sherman tree or the General Grant tree. Did you ever look at those big behemoths and say, hey, that would be a lot of lumber or a lot of fence posts?
Yeah, we looked at those nice big ones standing, and we said, wow, we sure wish we could work one of those instead of this you might say, trash that we're working on now. But there was one dead one up there that's still standing. And back during the days when we were working up there, my dad thought several times of just boring holes around in the base of that tree and putting in a little dynamite in each hole and blowing that thing down and say, well, it looked like the wind blew it down, you know, so we were working it up. But we never did. It's still standing there.
You probably would have gotten away with it back then, but today I think I'd be interviewing you in a federal penitentiary, so it's a good thing that didn't happen. And not to dwell on it too long, but I'm curious, just knowing that you're from that area and spent most of your life around there, people are so partial to Yosemite, and it gets so much publicity, and it's a beautiful place. But what about you? Do you sense a little rivalry there? And is there something that you appreciate about Sequoia and Kings Canyon in that area that you think is even better than Yosemite?
Well, Yosemite is pretty good competition for these parks up here, but these parks are close, and they've got some beautiful scenery. Of course, you go from there on down into Cedar Grove and view that beautiful country down in there. Hume Lake is a great place to go visit. And a nice lake. Yosemite gets a lot more publicity than Sequoia Kings Canyon gets here.
You're not going to take a side in the matter?
Sure, I'd take the Sequoia Kings Canyon side.
I thought you might. Well, Okinawa, I think, was a lot different than hanging out in the beauty of a national park, especially when there were Japanese making bonsai charges and firing away at you. But before we get to that, why don't you tell me what you remember about December 7th, 1941. Where were you and how'd you find out that the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor?
I was at Dunlap, and it was a Sunday morning, and I'd been out hunting. Like I said, I did a lot of hunting. And I came in, and my parents told me that Pearl Harbor had been attacked. I could almost still feel the shock that went through my body at the time, because even though I said, well, I think I was 14 at the time, I'm too young, the war will be over before I get to go in. But it was still really a shock to me to hear that the Japanese had done that to us.
I know in places like where you live now in Visalia or up in Fresno or some of the east side cities in the valley, there were a lot of Japanese Americans in those communities. And the school kids had Japanese American students in all their schools. What about in Dunlap? Were there any Japanese in those parts?
No, I don't remember any Japanese up there, but I had gone to school down at Dianuba with real good Japanese friends of ours. And I really hated to see them go into the internment camps, but I was kind of thinking if the Japanese could do that to us at Pearl Harbor, they could do anything to us. And so it didn't bother me too much that they were put in the internment camps.
At the time, it's certainly understandable that you would feel that way. When you think back on it now, do you have a different perspective, having seen everything and read everything and experienced everything?
Oh, yes. It's quite an injustice to them for us to do that to them, looking back on it now, because they were as good as citizens as we were, and it probably shocked them about as much as it did us for the Japanese homeland to do that to us.
So when Pearl Harbor happened, you still had a couple years left of high school. How is it that you ended up one of the few, the proud, the Marines?
Well, at the time, my father and mother had bought a place just north of Visalia. They established an air base out there, Sequoia Field, where they were training cadets. I think I was 16. I got a job working at Sequoia Field, pre-flighting Ryan and Stearman aircraft. We had to go to work at 4 a.m. in the morning. We were assigned generally 12 airplanes to start and warm up and have them ready to go at 6 o'clock when the cadets came out on the line and started their practice runs. So I was working at Sequoia Field at the time.
I bet that was kind of exciting, working with those airplanes and keeping them running.
It was. It was exciting. It was very dangerous, too, because at 4 a.m., it's dark out there, and those props spinning around. I remember we had one co-worker who got his left ear cut off, but he was fortunate that that's all he lost in that accident. There was times it was fun. After we pre-flighted the planes, we'd start gassing them up when they'd come back in needing fuel, And I was on the back of a gas truck. They'd pull up to a plane, and we'd fuel it up right quick. And we had a pull arm back on the back of the gas truck that if the driver was trying to leave a little soon, that we didn't have the hose out of the plane, we could pull that lever, and he couldn't go. It would pull the clutch in. And I was playing with him one day, pulling the clutch in, and he hit the brake real hard, and my head bounced up against the end of the hose where we were putting the gas in and put a big gash in my left eyebrow. So that was the first casualty of the war there, when I was fooling around playing when I should have been working.
A lesson learned. I don't want to get too far off track here, but you mentioned the names of those aircraft, the Ryan and the Stearman. These M1 shells you have here on the table look a lot like the Ryan. It's just kind of like a long bullet with an open cockpit and an interesting sounding airplane, isn't it?
Yes, it was. It was an interesting and a very neat little plane. It was some of the cadets, they had a preference. Some had a preference of the Stearman, and some had a preference of the Ryan. We never did get to, we were tempted to taxi one down the field every once in a while, but I never did, so.
The gash over your eyebrow was enough after you took that chance. So you're there working where Air Corps cadets are training. When did you get this idea that the war might last long enough for you to get involved?
We would come to town on Saturday night, and as civilians, we couldn't get a girl. We couldn't get a date, because they all liked the nice Air Force uniforms. We couldn't get any good whiskey, because the good whiskey was all reserved for them. We couldn't get any good cigarettes. All we could get was cool menthols. So two of my buddies and I, we decided, hey, why don't we enlist and get a uniform? Then we can get a girl. And so we all decided, let's do that. And so we went to the recruiter here in Visalia, and we all wanted to go in the Navy. We wanted to stay together. He says, no problem. So he stamped our papers, Navy, Navy, Navy. Then they shipped us to San Francisco. And we got up there, and a Marine recruiter took me, an Army recruiter took Art Smith, and a Navy recruiter took Jack Taylor. And after about 30 minutes, the last thing my father told me, said, son, whatever you do, don't let them put you in the Marine Corps. He had been in the Army in World War I. In the cavalry, and he knew the Marines were a dangerous part to be in, so he advised me that. But anyway, I argued with the Marine recruiter for about 30 minutes, and he said, well, I got to leave for a little bit. Think it over. So I thought it over, and I knew he was going to put me in the Marines whether I wanted to or not. So when he came back, I said, all right, I'll go. So they put me in the Marines, they put Art in the Army, and Jack Taylor put him in the Navy. So they really split us up there.
So much for the best laid plans there. So you're in the Marines now. I guess they had to whip you into shape. Was that a tough job for you, or were you already in pretty good shape from all that work you'd been doing?
Well, I was in good shape, but it was still Marine Corps boot camp at San Diego was so hard for me, because I was only 5'4", weighed 140 pounds, and here I was in there with 6'4", 6'5" guys. And when you're marching, trying to keep up with guys that's got that long of legs, I almost had to run all the time, and it was really hard. We were right next to the air base down at San Diego there, and we had one sergeant. His name was Sergeant Learn. He talked like he had, or he gave his commands like he had a mouthful of hot mush. He was hard to understand, and with the wind blowing, I caught one time I didn't hear his command, and I marched right up to the fence joining the Air Force down there with the Marine base. And I was standing there marking time, afraid to look around, because they had these what they call swagger sticks. And we had the old pith helmets, and they'd come down over your head with a swagger stick and that pith helmet on. It sounded like a bomb went off on your head. And when I finally, after 2 or 3 minutes, I finally got brave enough to kind of look around. And there the platoon was all down about 50 feet behind me, waiting on me. And so when I got back in ranks, he said, Flynn, take that man's name. He'll do extra duty this afternoon. And so boot camp was really, really hard. I remember one time we went to Chow, and of course they run a lot of men through there for breakfast. I had a frog in my throat, so I kind of got it up and spit on the pavement. The sergeant saw me, so that afternoon we went out where it was sandy, and he sat the platoon down and said, Anderson, take your little shovel that you have and start digging. So I dug down to where I could just barely look out over the top of it, and he said, now spit in it. And of course, my mouth was so dry, I couldn't spit, but I made the motion. And he said, now cover it up. And he said, now let that be a lesson to you and all the rest of you men, that if every man came down for breakfast here, spit on the pavement, nobody'd be able to stand up. And so that was one of the hard things. And every day they'd march us around and tell us what all we could be shot for. And it's amazing what you can be shot for when you're in Marine Corps boot camp.
Sounds like they put the fear of God in you.
Oh, they did. They did. It was really hard. But I'm really proud to be a Marine because, like I told, I was teaching Sunday school class one day up at Dunlap Baptist Church. I said, Marine Corps boot camp helps me every day of my life. I said, you don't see any hair on my bar of soap. Because when they had inspection, if they picked up your bar of soap and saw a hair on it, you probably scrubbed the toilet with your toothbrush that afternoon. And so I heard a little chuckle in the back of the room, and I said, what's that? And some lady says, you don't see much on your head either. So,
not anymore anyway, but I've got some pictures here to prove there was plenty of it on that head in World War II when our guest Dale Anderson served in the U.S. Marine Corps, 1st Marine Division, and we're going to get some of those stories when Hometown Heroes continues next on KMJ. After a down-to-the-wire Bulldog game, there's nothing quite like throwing yourself onto a comfortable bed. Paul Leffler here. You know, I heard my buddy Ray Ocanto talking about his mattress on the radio, and I thought, wait just a second. Wait till I tell you about the one my wife and I found at Sleep Retreat. Sleep Retreat is Fresno's only premium bedding store on El Paso, right next to Fashion Furniture. I heard Ray use the word comfort, but I can't imagine any bed being more comfortable than the Tempur-Pedic Cloud Luxe we're sleeping on. It's soft where you want it to be soft, firm where you want it to be firm, and if you really want the long and short of it, it doesn't matter if your legs are long or short. My wife Tanya's about 5'1 and petite. I'm 6'3 and not so petite. But that oh-so-comfortable Tempur-Pedic mattress fits us both like a glove. I guess I should have seen it coming. After all, Tempur-Pedic invented memory foam. Tempur-Pedic is the most recommended sleep surface in America. And nobody in Central California knows Tempur-Pedic better than the fine folks at Sleep Retreat on El Paso next to Fashion Furniture.
Hey, this is Paul Leffler, and if you've been listening to KMJ for any length of time, you've probably heard me wax poetic about my hometown of Las Banas at one point or another. Every city has its secrets, and I'm going to fill you in on one my old neighbors have been keeping for 40 years. No matter where you live in the valley, you probably go through Las Banas every once in a while, so next time you're cruising down the 152, pull into Ming's Restaurant. The owner, Paul Cito, has been showing off his skills in the kitchen there since 1968. He has perfected the best Mongolian beef this side of the Great Wall. Delicate rice noodles underneath tender slices of beef with a flavor I can't even put into words. Whether you prefer mild, medium, or spicy, you'll be coming back for more. Ming's is closed on Mondays, so don't say I didn't warn you. But stop in any other day and try the pork wonton soup, Chinese chicken salad, or get everyone's attention with the sizzling chicken and vegetables. The possibilities are endless, but they all have one thing in common. Ming's time-tested commitment to taking your taste buds on a thrill ride. Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in Las Banas.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Visiting today with a Marine Corps veteran of World War II, Dale Anderson of Visalia, California. Grew up in Dunlap out near Kings Canyon in Sequoia National Parks. He's got a few souvenirs. I'll post some pictures on kmjnow.com, show you the couple of things that he used during World War II or brought home from World War II. After hearing about boot camp, I think it's probably impressive to some of our listeners that you survived boot camp as a 5'4" teenager with the Marine Corps. And then you were going to have to go overseas. Were you anxious to get out of the States and get somewhere where you could get into some action, or were you kind of nervous about that?
No, I was anxious. We'd had our training, even though we were supposed to have 12 weeks basic and 12 weeks advanced training. I had the 12 weeks basic, but I only had 3 weeks advanced training, and they shipped us over. And of course, the war was Iwo Jima was a battle that was going on then, and we were anxious to get over and do our part to try to push the Japanese back to their homeland.
So this was the spring of 1944 when you're leaving the West Coast, and I bet you stopped in Hawaii on your way over there.
Yeah, we stopped in Hawaii. We were there, it seems like, about 7 days, and we were able to go downtown one day, and we'd heard so much about the Hawaiian pineapple juice. We were all anxious to try that Hawaiian pineapple juice. So we went in, and I think a glass of that was 80 cents, which was a lot back then. And so they served it up, and it was the worst pineapple juice I have ever had in my life. It was so sour that I don't think we even drank all of it. And then they gave us a tour of the island out where they grew the pineapple. But we were there for about a week.
Well, I guess if that's the worst thing that happened to you, it wouldn't be so bad. But there were some more challenging things lying ahead for you. Where'd they take you from there?
We went on to Guam, and we spent almost 30 days in Guam. That's where my hair started to slip, was on Guam, because the humidity, the heat, and the rain. It rained almost every day we were there. And then we had a heavy typhoon while we were on Guam. Kind of blew our tents pretty bad there.
But that island was already secured by American forces, so no battle situations yet.
No, Guam was already secured. I don't know why they left us there so long when they were needing. We were in the 62nd replacement draft when we went over, and they were needing. We heard later that 9 out of 10 of us that were going over in those replacement drafts were being killed at the time. But they left us on Guam for about 30 days, and then we headed on toward Okinawa.
Now, before we get to Okinawa, you mentioned 9 out of 10 being killed. And at this point, I mean, you're in the Marine Corps, and I'm sure you've heard about what's happened to the Marines at places like Tarawa or Guam or Iwo Jima. Even more close to what was happening then. Was that intimidating? Did that cause some fear in you, knowing what could happen to you?
Yes, it caused fear, but it kind of also gave us more determination to go get the job done.
All that price that had already been paid in this war, that it wouldn't be worth anything if you guys didn't finish the job? Is that kind of what you're saying?
That's right. That's what we were thinking, yes.
So what did you know about this place called Okinawa?
Not a thing. Not a thing, except that it was really well fortified. We had heard that, but we didn't know much. About a day before we got to Okinawa, a kamikaze plane came at our ship. The Navy and the Marines always kind of jaw against back and forth against one another, but I always really liked to hand it to the Navy boys, because they were able to shoot that kamikaze plane out of the air, and it landed about a block from our ship. Otherwise, probably I wouldn't be telling this story today.
And by this time, the kamikaze phenomenon had been practiced for a while by the Japanese, so you guys knew what that plane's intent was. Did you actually see it heading for the ship?
Oh, yes, we sure did. I sure did. Yes, I saw it heading for the ship. And that was a pretty scary moment for us, but we were so rejoicing, and a cheer went up through the whole ship when they were able to shoot it down, so it didn't get our plane. It landed in the ocean and then blew up as it landed, so I was really thankful for that.
And that's a lot closer call than most of us can relate when it comes to military experiences, but you were in for some more close calls once you hit land there at Okinawa. Tell us about coming onto that island and what you encountered.
The northern half of the island was secured, and we landed toward the southern half of the island. Naha City was one of the big cities that was there close. As we came in the LST boats, he didn't get quite far enough in the shore, I guess because of the coral reef. But anyway, as I stepped off of the edge of the boat, of course, I had my pack and my weapon, and I sank all the way under. I could not touch the ground, and had it not been for a couple of big 6'4" guys catching me under each arm and taking me in about 20 feet before I could even touch the ground, I'd have probably died right out there before I even got into battle. But we didn't take any fire as we were going in on the beach, but they loaded us in trucks, and started taking us inland because the battle was raging inland. As we just kind of started out down this dirt road, kind of going uphill, I looked over the side and I saw just a half of a body laying in the trench from the rib cage up. And we had a sergeant with us, Sergeant Ferguson, that had been over there before. This was his second tour. And I said, "Sarge, I just saw a piece of a body laying there." And he said, "You're going to see a lot of those from here on in." And he was right. Before we went in another probably mile, it was just getting dusk. And there must have been at least 20 of those half of bodies. It seemed like that the Japanese, when they were knew they were going to be captured, they would blow themselves up. And that was because of those bodies laying along there. And they took us in that night, and they bedded us down under about 8 or 10 10-inch guns, big guns, booming all night long. And they bedded us down under there, and they said, "You don't move from here tonight. If you got to go to the bathroom, just roll over and go. But if you get out of your sacks, you're liable to get shot before morning." And so we stayed close. We didn't get much sleep, but that was when we went in on Okinawa there.
And shot not by the Japanese, but by your own guys, thinking maybe you were Japanese coming into your camp. So you're 18 years old. You're on this island halfway across the world from where you grew up, and you've seen pieces of bodies everywhere. You're hearing these booming guns. What are you thinking that night as you try to get some sleep?
I was thinking, I sure hoped we had good guards that was standing guard duty, because every once in a while you'd hear of a guard going to sleep. So I couldn't really sleep soundly, and I still don't, because I was always afraid that a guard might go to sleep and instead of standing his post.
So that was the first night. You've seen some of the effects of this battle, of this war that cost so many lives worldwide, but you haven't experienced it all firsthand just yet. I imagine you didn't have to wait very long.
No. I think the next night or two, as we marched on in from there, one night, in fact, that's what I got the sword here from the souvenir. We were in our foxholes, and we had heard that the Japanese were going to make a banzai attack on our unit. We thought we were ready, but just about dawn, we heard them making a lot of noise. They were getting all doped up and everything. They tell us that they got, I don't know what kind of dope they used, but they got dope where they couldn't feel much pain. But they came at us with their swords hollering, "Banzai, Banzai." And, of course, we were started firing at them. And I wasn't aiming. I was just firing from the hip at this one big the Japanese were big on Okinawa. They were big Marines. But anyway, I kept firing. I thought somebody had maybe given me blanks for my weapon because he wasn't falling like he should have. But finally, he fell right at the edge of my foxhole, and I got his sword here laying on the table. But that was a scary time. We did repel the whole Japanese unit there, kill most of them, but they were pushed back.
And I'll put a picture of this sword on our website at kmjnow.com and on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page so people can take a look at that. I imagine you look at it fairly regularly. You've had to replace the handle on it because you probably showed it to a few people over the years telling these stories. When you see it now, what do you think of? And how difficult was that to go through that experience as a teenager?
It was very difficult back then, but it brings back, it brings back tears to my eyes now because when I think about it and think how close I come to getting my head lopped off there, and some of the other guys that got killed, none of them got their heads taken off, but some of them were killed with the swords. But it is difficult, but it's so important that we pass this history on, so hopefully we never have another war like we had back then, or any war, for that matter of fact. History is so important to our younger generation.
Amen. That's why this show is here. That's why we're doing this here today. And in your case, if that Japanese soldier had gotten you with this sword that's an ever-present reminder of it, you never would have met your wife of almost 66 years now, Fern, you wouldn't have your two children that you had, or seven grandchildren, 10 great-grandchildren. A lot of people would have been affected. And you saw the effects of those around you being killed. And I know you have the perspective now, but if you can, put yourself in your mind then as an 18-year-old. How did you get beyond that the next day? Because that's enough to weigh someone down and really cripple them with just the weight of what was happening there. What do you think it was that helped you get through it and get on to another day?
Well, looking back on it, I think it was God that was directing and guiding this, even though I didn't know Christ at the time, but he brought me through it. But it was hard. I remember one morning we were going to chow. The mess hall was up on the hill. The island was almost secured at the time. I was passing by this small two-man tent, and I heard this explosion. One of my good buddies came crawling out on his hands and knees out of the tent, and there was a stream of blood about the size of your index finger shooting out his right temple. Every time his heart would beat, it would just and of course he died there in just a matter of seconds. And the other fella named Gil Belcher, he was about 6'6" tall, and he came out of the tent all bent over, but he was running and screaming, and he just ran in a big circle out, and the guys had to catch him to hold him down. I thought that they had been playing with a landmine and it went off, but that's not the case. One of them was cleaning his rifle, and as he pushed down to putting his rifle back together, he pushed down on a landmine, and that's what exploded. And he had like 170 pieces of shrapnel. He lived, but he got to come home, but he lived through it. But I didn't go on to breakfast. It made me sick at my stomach when I saw that blood pouring out of his head there. So it just spoiled my appetite that day.
I can imagine. That is an awful lot for an 18-year-old to deal with. Those things are really severe and life-threatening. But there was another malady that you were just telling me about that I'm sure wasn't limited to the Marines, but anyone who used the M1 rifle, and you have a beautifully preserved M1 sitting right here that I'll take a photo of. But you were telling me about the M1 thumb. And I've interviewed a lot of veterans that use that gun. No one's ever told me about the M1 thumb. Tell our audience what that's all about.
Well, when you pull the breech of the M1 back and you insert a clip of 8 rounds of ammo, you push it down in there, and to get the breech to go forward, you have to kind of pull back with your thumb or your little finger, pull back on that and push down the ammo down in hard with your thumb, and as you let go of the breech, it will move forward, locking it in.
It's spring-loaded there, so it goes in a hurry, yeah.
Yeah. If you don't get your thumb out of there, it'll smash your thumb, and that's what you call M1 thumb. They showed us that in boot camp, but when we were up on the firing line, several of the fellas got that because they didn't get their thumb out of the way fast enough.
So you never had to deal with it? You never got your thumb caught in there?
No, I never got my thumb caught in there.
I'm glad for you that you didn't. I have a feeling that I probably would have done it too many times. Might not have a thumb still today.
Talking about the M1, when the last round was fired from the clip would spring out, and it makes a very familiar sound as it springs out. And the Japanese were aware of that sound, and they knew you had to get a new clip in your weapon. And so when they heard that sound, they would take advantage of that and try to attack you before you could get another clip in your weapon.
So you had to be pretty quick when reloading. And speaking of quick, boy, is this hour going by in a hurry. Time for another break. When we come back, more from World War II Marine Dale Anderson. If you go to KMJNow.com, you'll see a photo of Dale holding a little doll he was handed 68 years ago. The story behind that keepsake and the rest of Dale's World War II experiences when Hometown Heroes continues next on KMJ. Hey, Bulldog fans, Paul Leffler here, coming to you not as the voice of the dogs, but as a husband and father of two.
Ever have a hard time finding a restaurant that's family-friendly, won't set you back a week's pay, and has the kind of food that makes you want to keep coming back? I think I found it. And no, it's not one of those chains. It's one of a kind. Luna's Pizzeria, an Italian restaurant on Pulaski Avenue in Old Town Clovis. The Liberta family's been serving up great, authentic Italian food in the heart of cowboy country for more than 40 years. The pizza dough is made from scratch daily, and so is the bread. You won't forget the bread. I'm a sucker for that bread and the meatballs and the ravioli. And hey, did I say family friendly? How do you top a kid's menu with nothing over $3.95, drink included? I'm not making that up. See for yourself at lunasclovis.com. And while you're there, check out the family meal deals. That's lunasclovis.com or 299-4141. Tell them I sent you. And if you really want to, bring me back some bread. Luna's Pizzeria and Italian Restaurant. You'll love it at Luna's. A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis. Its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K-12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting with Visalia's Dale Anderson about his experiences on Okinawa with the 1st Marine Division. So you told us about your first experience, and what a way to get welcome to the war, to have a bonsai charge in the dark at night. But the battle went on for quite a while there on Okinawa. What other kinds of things did you experience there?
Well, the island had a lot of big caves. There was a lot of bags of black powder ammo left around from that. And as we would go out on patrol, one day we were walking down this dirt road, and there was sugarcane on each side of the road. Sugarcane was up about 5 feet high. And we would always walk about 8 feet apart in case somebody lobbed a grenade over into our ranks. It wouldn't kill that many. One day, this Sergeant Ferguson, he carried a 30 caliber carbine. He just turned and fired, and about a few seconds after he fired, we heard this thud. Just after we heard the thud, here came pieces of blood and guts and everything and landed on us, and we didn't realize what had happened. Real soon, but Fergie said a Japanese had raised up ready to throw a grenade over in our ranks, and that's when he saw him and he shot him. The Japanese fell, and when he fell, his grenade went off, and that's what threw that blood and guts all up around over us. Back during World War II, gold teeth from the Japanese was a favorite souvenir to bring home. And we had one guy by the name of Robert L. Bergstrom from, I think he was from Oregon. He was crazy after these gold teeth. And so he went over and rolled that Japanese over. And he said, maybe he's got some gold teeth. And so he rolled him over, and he took his rifle butt and he smashed him in the mouth to get his gold teeth broke loose. But the Japanese, in his throes of death, he swallowed those. And so that's when put his bayonet on and ripped his throat open. Of course, nowadays he'd be charged with, a war crime. But pretty soon as we went on, started on down that road, he came hollering, "I got him, I got him." And he got two gold teeth out of that Japanese. We went on down from there. This same sergeant, now where it was grass on each side of the road, high grass, about almost 3 feet high, and there was a dry canal running down along, and there was a big willow tree down on the side of that. As we approached that willow tree, Fergie just turned and fired in the grass, again with his 30 caliber. He had sharp eyes, but he turned and fired, and a woman fell out. He had shot her right down through the top of the head. All he saw was black hair at the time he shot. He didn't know it was a woman. But he shot her right down through the top of the head, and the bullet came out her left cheek, blew it out. And just almost immediately after that, two big Japanese was running down this dry canal. Of course, they were both killed almost immediately. Then we went up to the tree and went down, and there was a cave about 3 or 4 feet in diameter. And if you came to a cave that had flies flying around the mouth of it, you knew it was occupied. We had a Okinawan that was friendly to us that we took along as an interpreter. So we sent him into the cave to see if there was anybody in there to try to get him to surrender and come out. And in just a little bit, this old grandma, she must have been 80 or better, and about a 10-year-old girl came out. Of course, they both had their hands up. The little 10-year-old girl had this little doll in her hand. And she bowed and she held out the doll to me. And I made the motion that I didn't want it, but she did it again. So I took this little doll, and I've had it all these years. They were sent to a repatriation a holding camp, but it's hard memories.
Yeah, and you still do have that doll, and it's one of those things maybe where a picture is worth more than 1,000 words when you look at that and you think of all that it signifies about that war, the things you witnessed. And seeing something like that, I'm sure in the Marine Corps, you guys had been trained to really not think too fondly of the enemy and the people you were fighting. When you saw a grandmother and a little girl handing you a doll, did that alter your perspective or put more of a human face on what was going on there on Okinawa?
We knew they couldn't hurt us, or we didn't think they could hurt us, so we were sympathetic toward them because we figured it was probably a whole family that had been wiped out that day. This was probably the grandmother, and the first lady that Fergie killed was probably the mama of the little girl, and then the two was running down the ditch that got killed. They were probably her sons or her brother. And so it was a whole family that was probably wiped out that day. That's just hard when you think back on it.
Yeah, it seems like that's part of the explanation of what you said earlier, that you hope there's never another war like the one you guys were in.
Yes, sure is.
So this Battle of Okinawa, the last major land battle of World War II, did you have any kind of inkling when it was winding down that things might be over for you soon?
No, we were still, we were preparing for mainland Japan, and we were all dreading that battle. Even though we were Marines, we were dreading the Battle of mainland Japan because the way Iwo Jima had been fortified and Okinawa had been fortified, we knew mainland Japan was going to be really, really bad. I always had to hand it to President Truman at the time for making the hard decision to drop the atomic bombs on Nagasaki and Hiroshima. That was a mighty hard decision he had to make. But I'm probably alive today because he did make that decision.
No question. So by mid-August, Japan is surrendering, and you guys don't have to go over there, and I imagine you Marines celebrated just a little bit.
Yeah, we celebrated a lot with some Japanese sake. One kind of fun thing that we had, it was July, the island was secured, so I had brought in a bag of this black powder with granules about the size of your index fingernail. I decided I'd have a little fun. Of course, we were drinking a little sake at the time, too.
This wasn't just being stupid. You knew how to work with black powder from your days blowing up giant trees in the forest for lumber back before the war, right?
That's right. Yes, that's we did. I'd had some experience with black powder and dynamite. And we used to buy our dynamite from a place there in Orange Cove. I think the little building is still there where they kept the dynamite out back.
So when the 4th of July rolls around on Okinawa, you want to celebrate like all your fellow Americans back home. You find some black powder. What kind of fireworks did you produce, and how'd you pull it off?
Well, I found a pipe, a 3/4-inch pipe, about 3 feet long. We were bivouacked right along a river there, and so I stuck this end of this pipe down in the edge of the bank, kind of pointed it out over the river, and filled it with black powder and whittled me out a wooden plug to go in it. But I didn't have a fuse. I didn't have a way to set it off. And it was getting toward dusk. I looked over about 100 feet or so, and we saw a column of gnats about 4 foot high and about a foot around that was just static. And I thought, well, that's strange to hear, to see gnats flying around in a static position. So I said, well, let's go investigate. So a couple of buddies and I, we went over. It was an old house that had been all blown to pieces. We threw back some boards. Here was a big crock with about an 8-inch mouth on it, and it was almost 3 feet deep, buried in the ground. And, of course, these gnats were flying right over the top of that. And I got to thinking, well, I know gnats like vinegar, so maybe it's a jug of vinegar. So I took my canteen cup and dipped down in it and smelled of it. Don't smell too bad. So I tasted of it. Ooh, it even tastes even better. So it was a whole jug of Japanese sake. So I filled both canteens. Of course, the canteens were aluminum back then. I filled both canteens, went back to camp, tore off a piece of my shirt, dipped it down in it, stuck it down in the pipe, let the end of it come over and stuck a match to it. And it burnt down in that black powder, and those big granules of black powder came out over that river just real pretty, nice.
Lit up the sky?
Lit up the sky. And I was getting ready to load up again. I kind of looked down by where the pipe was, and I saw these two shoes. They must have been size 14 or 16. They were, I think, the biggest boots I'd ever seen. And I slowly looked up. And it was a captain, and he said, Anderson, what are you trying to do? And I said, well, just have a little fun, sir. It's 4th of July. And he said, your fun is over. He said, we thought we were under, the officers were bivouacked upon the hill. And he said, we thought we were under attack again, so you quit that. So the next day, we were out on patrol, and I decided I'd have a drink of water out of my canteen that I'd filled last night. And so as I pulled that aluminum canteen out of the canteen cup, the whole bottom of that canteen came off. It was just disintegrated from that Japanese sake. And so you can imagine what it would do to your stomach.
Pretty strong stuff. And if you're thinking at home about making a sake-soaked wick to stick in a pipe full of black powder, maybe you should think twice about that. But you survived all that and didn't get in too much trouble, I guess. And then after the war was over, maybe you thought you were going to come home, but you didn't have such luck, huh?
No, we were really rejoicing that we were going to get to come home. And then we got the orders. They were going to ship us into China, occupation troops to try to stop the communists from taking over China. So that was kind of a downer. But we went on into Tenzin, China. It was a pretty large city. If we'd have walked straight from where they unloaded us from the trucks to the old English barracks where we stayed, it would have probably just taken us a couple of hours. But they marched us 8 miles around through the city so the whole city could see that we were a show of force there. And the people were so glad to see us. The Chinese were so glad to see us that they just wanted to hug us. And they had little American flags that they would stick down in each rifle barrel as we carried our rifle on a sling over our shoulder. They would stick these little flags down in. So after the 8 mile march, it had been a long day in a way, and I gave out. At that time, I was carrying the BAR.
Browning automatic rifle, which is a lot heavier than what you had before.
Yes, it's heavier than the M1 Garand. And I had 10 20-round clips of ammo. We wore an ammo belt with suspenders on it that we had that ammo in. And I was completely give out. And so there was others that was giving out also. So I told Sarge, I can't go anymore. And he said, well, catch a rickshaw. And, of course, there was a lot of rickshaws there along. And so I motioned for one, and here he came. And I was taking off my ammo belt, and he raised the rickshaw seat, and I just put my ammo down in under there, got on. He took me to the old English barracks. I guess it was about a mile, and I think it paid him a nickel. They told us not to overpay when we got in there. You keep it low. So I walked about 10 feet or so, and I realized, oh, I don't have my ammo belt. And I turned and looked, and that rickshaw driver was nowhere to be seen. He got well paid more than a nickel because he got all my ammo. So as soon as I got in the old English barracks, I told the lieutenant what had happened because I like to get things out real quick. And everybody was so tired, they were just kind of collapsing wherever they could and went to sleep. And he said, well, son, as long as you have it by 10 o'clock in the morning for inspection, don't worry about it. I said, yes, sir. So I caught another Marine sleep that had about the same amount of ammo that I did. And so I confiscated his ammo, and I had mine at 10 o'clock the next day.
What happened to him, though?
I have no idea.
You spent 11 months there on China. What did you get out of that experience?
Well, I got to go up and stand on the Great China Wall. That was a great experience. Mainly this, I got to learn not to eat the Chinese vegetables that they had grown locally, because our toilets, after we, when we first got in there, we just had to dig a long trench, and you just had to squat one behind the other if you had to go to the bathroom. That's where you went. But in 2 or 3 days, we got toilets fixed up. These guys, we called them honey bucket drivers. They'd come along with a cart, and the toilets had a flap on the back that you could lift up, and they would shovel dung out of the toilets and load it into these carts, these honey bucket carts, and take it out and put on their vegetable gardens. And so they told us not to eat the local vegetables. And so we would see that happening every day. They'd come every day and clean the toilets out. But the Chinese people were very friendly, very, very nice people. And we were there. It was cold there during the winter. The rickshaw's drivers were great. And, of course, at that time, the girls were great, too. So it was quite a time there in China.
What did it feel like when you finally got word that you were going to get to come back home to the States?
Well, it really felt good. I was anxious, really anxious to come home, see my parents. It was a wonderful feeling, wonderful news to hear that we were going to get to come home. When I went in, I signed up for immediate induction, and I went in for the duration of the war and 10 years in the reserve. So got to come home, but I was still in the Marine Corps Reserve. Even though I was discharged, I was still in the Marine Corps Reserve.
Did you have any trouble getting from China back to the States?
Just a very rough seas. We hit a typhoon coming out of the Yellow Sea there in China, and I always got seasick the first couple days out. I'd get terribly sick, and that day I was so sick I didn't care whether I lived or died. It was just so sick, and they'd put us back on the aft of the ship, and there was about 20 of us back there in the same condition. And we were just sliding back and forth in our own vomit, or in everybody's vomit. And they'd come along about every hour with a big fire hose and hose us down. The ship was listing so much, and if it had another 2 degrees of list, it would have probably sunk. It took us 21 days to come home nonstop. Going over, we went over on the USS Pickaway, which was a troop transport. It wasn't a real large ship. As we sailed around Hawaii coming home, we were on our last leg of the journey. It was beautiful moonlight nights, and the porpoises were running along the ship, jumping. I remember that as the most enjoyable time of my service was on the way home. I left San Diego, and I came back to San Diego.
And grew up quite a bit in between after going over as a teenager. And well, if I mentioned earlier, if you didn't survive all of that, you never would have met your wife. And how'd you guys meet?
I came back, and I was an ice man. I was delivering ice to the ladies' homes. Because during the war, nobody could get new refrigerators, most of the ladies had ice boxes in their homes, and so I delivered ice. I was living in Ivanhoe, California. My wife was a nursing student in Lubbock, Texas. Of course, we had never met. Her sister was living next door to us in Ivanhoe, and so she came out to take care of her sister who had had surgery, and she and I started eyeballing one another over the fence, and And of course, I was juggling girlfriends at the time. But anyway, we started looking at one another, and so they had a birthday party for my wife and invited my buddy and I over to have ice cream and cake with them. And so we went over and had a good time, and when I went to leave, I had mentioned to her little niece that was 9 years old, Erlene, that I was going to the movie Saturday night. So she said to my wife now, said, Dale's going to the movie Saturday night. So I had to either be a gentleman and ask her or just let it run off. And so I said, yeah, would you like to go? Of course, I was an alcoholic at the age of 20. And so she said, only if you promise me you won't drink. And I said, okay, I can go one night without drinking. We went to the movie, and then I didn't want her to go with my buddy, Art Smith. Art, if you're listening, And so I asked her out again, and we started going together, and within 3 months, we got married. She was a Christian. I wasn't. And so she'd try to read the Bible to me at night, and I'd turn the light out because I didn't want to hear it. But it didn't take too long before I became a Christian, so that's how my wife and I met.
Sounds like it's the best thing that ever happened to you.
Yes, it truly was. And looking back on it, I can see the hand of God in guiding her out here so that an old lost sinner could be saved. These 66 years have been good together.
What I always like to ask, since I would love to be married for 66 years, I'm about a half century behind you on that, but what's your secret to maintaining a healthy marriage for more than six decades?
Well, it's having Jesus in our heart and in our home, because I know if I mistreat her, I've got to answer to him, and vice versa. And the staying in the church, we give God the glory for keeping us together these 66 years.
Proof's in the pudding there. Well, when you think back about your time in the service, and you mentioned earlier how important it is to you that this history is not lost, and that that your kids and grandkids and great-grandkids know what happened then, what would you share with the rest of us that you think we ought to know and remember about World War II and the men who served in that time?
I would like to see every able-bodied young man and young lady go through Marine Corps boot camp or a boot camp, and just remember that war is hell. There's no glory in war. And when you see your friends and your buddies killed and wounded and maimed, just remember that, as the old saying is, I think history can repeat itself. We don't want to ever repeat World War II in our nation. And so do your part in keeping America strong and safe.
Amen. Well, on behalf of our listeners, I just want to say thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us about it. And if people notice that you have a prosthetic leg, that's not a war injury. That happened in the logging industry later?
Yes, I came home from the war all one piece and went up to Mineral King, which is east of Visalia, and started logging up at Silver City, and got between two logs end to end, mashed my knee. They took me to Fresno Community Hospital and waited 10 days and amputated below the knee, trying to save the knee, and that didn't work. So they waited another 10 days and amputated above the knee. Still didn't hit enough blood, they thought, and they were going to have to go higher. And that night I promised God that if he'd let me keep that much leg, that I would faithfully serve him. And I've tried to do that through these 60 some odd years, but that's how I lost my leg.
And I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it occurs to me that maybe that circumstance that could be really devastating for a lot of people, and I'm sure was really challenging for you, maybe your experience in the war and the things you had to deal with as a young Marine prepared you for going through something that severe?
Yes, because this injury to me wasn't near as severe as some that I had seen during the war. And so I felt myself really lucky, or maybe blessed, that that's all that happened to me, that I just lost a leg.
Was there anything else that I didn't ask you about that you think people ought to know?
I was coming home from China. I had $600 that I'd saved up to buy a car when I got home. Oh, I wanted to get a car as soon as I got home. And I went down to the head just before I bedded down for the night. There was a crap game, dice game going on down in the head. And there was a lot of money in the game. I got in the game for about 10 minutes, and I won almost $600 just in less than 10 minutes. And so I thought, well, that gives me enough for now. That gives me $1,200, enough for a good car. So I'll go back up and go to bed. And we were sleeping up on deck, and I could not go to sleep. I kept thinking of all that money. So I got up out of bed, went back down, and lost the $600 that I had saved and the $600 that I earned, and lost it all, and I was sick all the way home. So now I can go into Reno or wherever these gambling places are and walk through, and it has absolutely no pull on me whatsoever. But that was a sad thing to lose all that money just in so little time.
Well, like you said, that lesson stuck with you, and I can see why. Your memory sure has lasted. You never lost that. Thanks again for sharing your story with us. That's Dale Anderson. Check out the photos on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page or at kmjnow.com. And join us again next Saturday for another installment of Hometown Heroes on KMJ.